This is Matt Wells at UN News. Inspired by the movement for the liberation of women, Professor Catherine MacKinnon established the legal grounds for defining sexual harassment as sexual discrimination and the concept of gender crime through her work with the International Criminal Court. Speaking to UN News about the Me Too movement against male exploitation, the UN Women Advisor warned that to achieve a true culture of respect, women need to be seen beyond objects for sexual use. She talked to Anna Carmo about the UN Gender Equality Agency's recent publication on sexual harassment and elaborated on what needs to be done to create a more equal society.
The movement for the liberation of women influenced me in the past and continues to do so. The contribution that I tried to make and seems to have, and has had a lot of uptake in the world, is the concept, really, that sexual harassment is a form of discrimination on the basis of sex. That is, it's fundamentally a practice of the inequality of the sexes. Mostly, it's imposed by men on women, but also can be imposed by anyone on the basis of gender on another person. And so the women's movement exposed a lot of the same kinds of sexual abuse that is now starting to come out to the rest of the general public in the Me Too movement, but women heard it from each other. And that made clear that all the vulnerabilities that characterize the vast diversity of women in particular targeted us for sexual aggression, including in settings, for example, at work, where our survival economically was on the line, but also in education and walking down the street and in public places, so that both our safety and our ability to make our way through the world, as well as simply to become who we actually are, was at stake, and on a sex discriminatory basis. So understanding that sexual harassment is a human rights violation, the next question is, okay, what human right does it violate? And the answer that I pioneered is the right to equal treatment.
You were mentioning that women knew from each other what they were feeling. What do you think it changed in how that made women start speaking out publicly?
One of the things that has been particularly productive in the last decade or so has been the possibility of social media connection. Women are able to have access to each other in autonomous and anonymous ways and without risking public exposure or retaliation. And also, they can feel each other out without necessarily saying who they are, but then come to identify themselves more particularly. There are, of course, dangers with this, but it has proven to be overwhelmingly positive. And that change has fundamentally made essentially millions of multilateral connections among women that previously weren't possible. Of course, it's limited to those who have the capacity to have access to computers and other and cell phones, means of communication. But many of us do, and many women around the world who don't even have clean water have a cell phone. So that has made a big difference. But it would have been possible that women whispering to each other in this medium could have simply been another place where a lot of stifled cries of pain went to die, you know, like so much has between women in the past. The acceptance of the possibility of these abuses being real and making public of them in a wholly different way by traditional media, legacy media, mainstream media, has had a tremendous influence on the acceptance in the world of the reality of this abuse. Ethical journalism is something else that actually has cracked open this world in a way that feeds back to women and also to men who read that stuff, who consume mainstream media and who understand things are real based a lot on that. Who have been, at least some of whom, have been taken aback, surprised, even shocked at how widespread sexual abuse is. They're only beginning to learn about that. Sexual harassment, especially at work, has started to come into view, but there is so much more around it, beneath it, that those of us who work with these issues have known about for 40 years or more. Those of us who have experienced it have known about it, of course, all along. And that's a whopping number of women and a lot of men who have also been abused and know well the reality. But the surfacing of it in public is what has changed.
What do you think are the next steps for the Me Too movement?
I think the Me Too movement is the next step. That what it is where it is going. Since it has begun, it hasn't stopped. It hasn't slowed. It has only found new ways and routes and spheres of operation. And it's slower in some cultures and countries than others, moves like wildfire in others. In many places, like say in Mexico, for example, all of a sudden we have 40 Me Too hashtags, all different ones, for different areas in which women work. That's just work. And then there's also the educational ones, and they're working on that. And those are just two places in life that women go where we've been permitted to, or we've permitted ourselves to speak out about what happens to us there. All the other places remain to be exposed.
You have been a key contributor to UN Women's recent publication on sexual harassment. What do you think is the role of the UN on addressing these issues?
Well, as the fundamental international organization, it's to bring the world together to consider problems in common in all their diversity. That makes it a perfect place for women to, in particular, and also men, to come together to talk about a problem like this, which is universal in its scope, but everywhere particular. So it's specifically cultural every place, even though it is culturally universal. That's exactly the kind of question that the UN is built to and is predicated on addressing in its structure and, of course, in its personnel. The UN also has a role as a massive employer of many, many millions of people and hundreds of thousands, and has a possibility not yet fully lived up to of being a model employer in this area as well as in others.
What do you think it still needs to change in society in terms of mentalities? Because we hear all these discussions about the movements and women speaking out, but it feels like the values in the societies need to change as well to accompany this revolution, I would call it.
Yes.
What do you think it needs to change in terms of society, in terms of values and mentalities?
They all come under the heading of equality, but equality in substance, you know, not just form. And cultures of respect, of understanding that, of seeing beyond women simply being objects for sexual use is where I would start. Men who say that now that it's possible that women might be believed if we say, when we say that we've been sexually aggressed against, all of a sudden they're not going to have lunch with us alone. To me, that says they lack the capacity to see women as anything other than sexual objects, as well as, of course, presuming that women lie, in particular about sex, which is one of the deepest, broadest stereotypes out there. All you have to do is communicate the basic view that women are not to be believed, particularly about sex, to make it possible to aggress against women freely, sexually, because anything we say will automatically be disbelieved. It's just it's a get-out-of-jail-free card. And also there's the notion that women, the automatic, somewhat reflexive notion that across many cultures that women are automatically fulfilled by anything sexual that is done to us. It's the notion that by nature we are asking for, wanting, not violated by anything that is sexual without even pausing to find out if it's something we actually want at the time or we are welcoming. You know, this has got to go. This, you know, notion that in particular, whenever a woman has had sex, then not only does no further sex ever violate her, based on the strange idea that any man can be substituted for any other man. Maybe they believe that. We do not believe that. But also the idea that we lose our credibility with our virginity you know, the minute we've ever had sex, suddenly you can't believe a word out of the woman's mouth. And the only way you get believed then is for there to be 3, 4, 5 women saying the same thing about the same man. Well, if that's required, what that means is that each woman is 1/4 of a person for purposes of credibility, you know, and that has to change. What also has to change is the devaluation of women based on our sexual usability, essentially. Because I think a lot of the credibility discussion is really about not valuing women at all. In other words, once a woman says what's been done to her, she's trash, she's damaged, and in any case, she's fulfilled in her nature. But the man is always valuable and valued, and if anyone took seriously damage that he had done to her, then something would be done to him. And, you know, his value automatically being high and hers automatically being low means that people just simply say, I don't believe her, as code for, if we took her seriously, we would have to do something real to somebody who matters. And she doesn't matter, and he does. So that relative hierarchy between the sexes, and also of masculinity over femininity, regardless of what sex biologically a person is or whatever their gender or gender identification is, that hierarchy has to go.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Yes, that until every form of social vulnerability that characterizes women as a group in all of our diversity is understood as being central to this problem, it won't be adequately addressed. That is, racism in racist societies, ethnicity, color, caste, where that's relevant, class, because it's relevant everywhere and produces massive poverty and economic desperation, is a major precondition for targeting of women for sexual harassment and abuse. Age and disability is extremely important to keep in mind. People are viciously sexually harassed and violated based on and through and because of a whole range of disabilities. And in addition, indigenous status targets people, women in particular, but also young boys for sexual aggression, and has actually for centuries. And religion is also often a potent ground for sexual harassment, not only for exclusion of people from equal benefits of all sorts, but when particularly women, again also some men, are definitely some men, are, say, well, all the way from targeted for genocide through to the everyday lived conditions that form the foundation for whole campaigns of crimes against humanity, all the way to situations that are not recognized as ones of conflict, but some religions predominate over others or consider themselves and are socially structured to be superior to others. Sexual harassment is a potent dynamic as within it's silencing of people on the basis of their particular religion, and it's a constant threat and needs to be understood in all of its cultural particularity in order to address the harms that are done through people's religious heritage and identifications. So every one of those intersectional vulnerabilities converges with gender, does a lot of their work through gender, and gender does a lot of its unequal work, hierarchical work, through all of those vulnerabilities. So they are all absolutely central to any adequate understanding and address of the problem.